Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Before this podcast begins, everyone at Roker Report would like to offer their deepest sympathies and condolences to the family and friends of Louise Wanless, a fiercely loyal and hard-working woman deeply loved and respected not only by those associated with the Sunderland AFC family, but far beyond, from clubs and staff across the footballing pyramid, to players, managers, officials, pundits, journalists, broadcasters, and so many more. She touched a great many lives, and the tributes flooding in since the news of her passing shows just how much of an impact she had as an ambassador for our club, for women in football, and for the wider region. She will be sorely missed by all who knew her. Rest in peace. Hello and welcome to the Roker Report podcast in association with Sunderland Community Soup Kitchen. My name is Rich Spate and I'm here in Wales on a windy hillside. So if you hear any background noise, I think it's the wind rustling through the trees. And I'm also joined on this special podcast today by Dave Rose of the Red and White Army Supporters Trust and the Footballer Supporters Association. How are things, Dave?
Yeah, good. Well, I'm on here from a very sunny and hot Silkswith, actually, so enjoying the weather and enjoying a little bit of a break from the season. And obviously, we weren't at the stadium alive very much at all, just the one game, but it's still nice to take a break from the anxiety and heartache that following Sunderland brings.
Yeah, I mean, you were back at the Stadium of Light for the playoff semis. I couldn't get up for it. What did you make of the day overall, the atmosphere, and just like kind of getting back into the ritual of it?
Well, it was obviously class to be back, and took my son, who's 14 now, and we're pleased that we could get the tickets, and we did a little bit of a traditional routine of just dodging for a bite to eat in the pub, met a few family and friends who were staying around the bar to watch the match on the TV. And we, it was just nice to do that walk over the town bridge. And, albeit it was sparse crowds walking over there, it still give you that little feeling back and that feeling of anticipation. Even popped in the wee chief for a couple and listened to a hearty rendition of Cheer Up Peter Reid from a few blokes in the corner. So that was... it was good crack, and it was just nice to be back. And then in the ground, I mean, club handled it very, very well. The safety officer and his team, they've done a massive job in preparing for it, and it showed. It was easy to get in. You knew exactly which way around. You had to walk around the concourses and queue for the toilets and things like that. But I guess more importantly, it was just amazing to sample a bit of the atmosphere again and remember what it's like. And there was only 10,000 in there, but it genuinely felt like a hell of a lot more, and that surprised us, because you imagine, like 10,000 spread right up to the upper concourse and all of that as well. And but still, yeah, made a good racket.
Definitely sounded like it on the telly when I was watching it. That sounded like there was 40,000 in there, and yeah, like everyone was enjoying themselves, well, at least for the first half, wasn't it? But it ended up being a disappointing end of the season, and subsequently, we've kind of seen some bold moves in terms of releasing senior players like Max Power. We've had encouraging words about kind of promotion of some of the under-23s. And we've also had the good news that the ladies team has gained, what they call it, upward movement, isn't it? to the Women's Championship. Do you remain generally kind of positive, despite obviously the setback we've had, about the direction of the club in general, in the footballing terms in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think many people would have argued with the retention list and who we let go. I mean, some, you know, fans have different views on this, so it's you never want to get too drawn into it from a supporters group point of view, because, you know, talk to 10 different people, you get 10 different opinions. But generally speaking, there was no real massive surprises in there, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we seem to have a settled approach and staffing and plan, and that we seem to be recruiting backroom staff where there's been, you know, massive gaps and voids from previous years, I think that's got to be encouraging. And that we're looking like we've got a plan and a consistent approach. And as with all these things, though, we've been hurt so many times and we've had so many false dawns, I think as a fan base, we're a bit battle-hardened and cynical. So I don't think I'd be alone in thinking, well, it all sounds good and we're going to be positive about it, but the proof will be in the pudding.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a big summer, isn't it? And obviously, there's going to be lots of ins and outs, and there's still things to be decided in terms of whether there's going to be a salary cap and things like that. But it does bring us on to kind of the financial side of things. Obviously, with the Red and White Army Sports Trust having the meeting the other day as part of the structured dialogue and alongside the other groups, you looked at the finances. In general, though, are you kind of convinced that Kirill Louis-Dreyfus really does mean what he says when he turned in terms of the cost cutting is going to be finished, or as he described it, the asset stripping, that's really coming to an end?
I think we talked about the proof of the pudding on the playing side of things, and I think we can already see some actual proof, more than words, around that when we had the meeting with them on the 26th, so a couple of weeks ago, at the structured dialogue meeting. We did ask that question. We referenced the fact that we'd had the smallest capital expenditure in the League One in the last set of accounts, and we asked what's been done to address this and to reverse that trend. And the answer was a pretty solid one. There's already work being undertaken at the academy, some structural stuff, obviously the staffing side we talked about, but also just facilities and things like that, and changing things around, making it a better environment for coaching staff and for the players. Also at the Stadium of Light, actually doing the whole of the corporate area, I believe. Like, I think it's been the same since the stadium opened, pretty much. So the boxes and imagine the Jimmy Montgomery suite and all of that area. They're already started on that. I think work started on that the evening after the playoff semi. So that's really good to hear. What we're all bothered about is what happens on the pitch, but it's an indicator, isn't it, that when they're doing things like that actually the main business, they're here, you would hope, for a reasonable amount of time. They're not looking to just come in and look at it short term, otherwise they wouldn't be investing in those sort of things. So that's encouraging.
Yeah, it really is. And obviously we've seen the pitch being pulled up as well straight after the semi, and he's had that new lighting rig on order, which I think was spotted being delivered as well by somebody. So, I mean, there's lots of good signs there, isn't there? So it's been a really interesting, traumatic year for many people, a very odd year for a football fan. And over the course of the last year, Red and White Army's been transformed into a sports trust, and you and the rest of the committee have kind of managed that process. How does it feel to have completed it?
A massive relief, just to get rid of the admin side. Really, it's not really why you get into this sort of thing. You know, you're wanting to help with positive change with the club and get fans' opinions and be that sort of voice and that conduit as best you can. So if anybody sold the idea of fan activism on the basis that you've got a lot of bureaucracy and administrative hoops to jump through, you probably wouldn't bother. But no, it's good that it's out of the way. We're registered with the FCA now. We are Sunderland's first ever supporters trust, which, you know, for those involved in making that happen, I don't want to overstate its importance, but it's just nice to have been part of that. And hopefully it'll be looked back on as a bit of a sort of watershed moment in terms of fan activism in the area and having like a solid voice that is very accountable and very open and very inclusive. I think we were anyway. I think we built that up quite a lot, whether you support the Red and White Army or not. From its inception, we've really tried hard to be as representative as possibly can be and be as diplomatic and professional with the club as we can be, but also making sure that we represent views. And sometimes those views have been pretty strong because of where we've been these past few years. So it was both the best time and the worst time to launch a supporters organisation, really. And in a similar way, going on to convert to a trust, strange to do it in the middle of a pandemic. That's not what we anticipated, but it was the right time to do it. People were getting at the wit's end a little bit with the previous majority ownership. It was getting more and more difficult. So I think it was an easy sell, if I was to put it that way, to say, you know, now's the time to just firm all this up. Having an organised supporters group, let's convert to a trust. And you never know what's going to be around the corner for a club. So it's best to at least have that sitting there ready to act.
Yeah.
Should we need it?
Totally. I mean, I think it was February last year when I first spoke to you about Red and White Army. We did an interview for the website and we spoke about actually whether converting to a trust would be on the agenda, and it moved up the agenda quite fast, really, didn't it? And it was in the absence of the day-to-day business of a supporters trust, really, in terms of the structured dialogue meetings, which had broken down by that point, and that was a bit of the catalyst, really, wasn't it? But
that's right.
You've had the first couple of structured dialogue meetings since the new regimes took over. How have they gone from the perspective of Red and White Army? We can see the minutes, but can you give us kind of a sense of the change in approach, or how the approach might differ from the way it did under Donald and Methven?
Yeah, I think like some things are the same. We're operating on the same terms of reference between the club and the supporter groups, the essence of which is we agree the agenda together, we agree the minutes together. So it's all sort of fair and upfront. So we're working on that basis still. It's probably fairer to compare it with the earlier days of Stuart Donald and Charlie Methven's meetings, which Charlie was sort of the main guy from the club's point of view on those. And they were quite open in terms of that we could ask anything we wanted at the time. But I think the big difference in starting out with the new regime is that they've been a very well prepared and professional. Basically created like a bespoke presentation for us as supporter groups. So you can see there's a bit of thought went into it. It's not just today's the day of the fans meeting. Let's you know, get along there and hear what they've got to say. They've actually put a bit of thought into it. And that's nice. That shows that there's a bit of a commitment there. So that's been good. I think it's been difficult because we've had one on Zoom, which was very difficult. And it was an introductory meeting anyway. And then we've had one sort of in the flesh at the Stadium of Light. But even then, because of social distancing, we had to be all on different tables. So it wasn't conducive to like a bit more of a conversation and flow. But that's not anyone's fault, that. But what I would say, they've been very professional, very welcoming, they're listening. And I think there's been a couple of little bumps where there could have been a bit more consultation on one or two things. But there's a steep learning curve, I'm sure, for those that have come in to understand Sunderland, the club, to pick up the pieces of what's been left. And also still in the pandemic as well. So it's obviously going to be a challenge for those new guys coming in terms of Steve Davidson and Christian Speakman. But yeah, it was good and I'm looking forward to the next one.
Great. I mean, there's obviously been a lot of change in personnel. And and maybe everyone needs to get it on their agenda. That consultation with the club is really important, whatever part of the club you're working in, maybe. What do you think are the most kind of pressing questions that remain unanswered at the club right now? When I looked at the minutes, it seemed to skirt around the issue of the kind of the precise breakdown of share ownership, and that seems to have caused some concern amongst fans in general. And also the notion that some decisions made at the club require more than just KLD's agreement and is obviously, and Sartori and maybe Donald and Metfin need to be consulted on certain things. These seem to be the big questions that we've had back through letters and social media. Are they the most pressing issues?
I think that's one of the pressing issues, yeah. It's to understand what that dynamic is. We asked the initial questions and set out what were the initial concerns from that we had from fans, because it's inevitable there's going to be concerns about Stuart Donald and Charlie Methven still pulling any strings or anything like that. They are still shareholders, mm-hmm. and along with Juan Satori, it's like believed to be around about 40%. So yeah, I guess there would be an expectation for them to have some representation on the board. That's something we need to keep an eye on as an organisation and delve a little deeper on. I think we sort of pushed that line of questioning as much as was comfortable for everyone. And we'll just have to watch and see, and hopefully there won't be too much cause for concern going forward. But that is something that fans ask us about all the time. So we're very conscious of that. And we won't shirk any questions mm-hmm. like that. Nor do we want a point score and drag over the past either. That's not what we're about. We've got new people in there, don't want to do that either. But whilst they are still shareholders, there is still pertinent questions to be asked around that, I think.
Definitely. I mean, trust is such an important currency in the relationship between clubs and fans, and building that trust, I think, is going to be important, and that's a really key point for me and for lots of other fans in terms of just the understanding. It's just understanding, isn't it? It's not necessarily looking to beat anyone over the fact that we know they've still got shares. And we know why they've still got them, because there's a potential of them making money, isn't there? But absolutely. I mean, obviously, we've been through a hell of a lot over the last few years, not just with Donald and Metfin, with Ellis Short as well, and all that's kind of resulted in the trust being formed. But the European Super League debacle seems to put kind of rocket boosters underneath the fan movement in England and across the rest of Europe, and I think more people than ever really aware of the Football Supporters Association, Fans Europe, and just supporters' trusts in general, and especially the idea of like fan representation on boards. It was on the agenda at the recent meeting, obviously, the kind of the fan-led review of football, which I know working for the FSA, you've got a good knowledge of. And there's going to be is it a working group set up between the club and the fan collective, is that right?
Yeah, I think it's obviously a big subject, so we're never going to sort of resolve a way forward on a fan on the board, which was the particular part of the fan-led review link that the club were interested in talking about after the Red and White Army had raised it. And I think it's good that there's a commitment to have some open discussions, and I think it's a bit of a keeping an eye on what's happening with the fan-led review, looking at what the other clubs are doing. But I also don't think they need to wait for the fan-led review outcomes. I think if we're talking about a club that wants to operate transparently and respectfully with the supporters, then out of the tens of thousands of football fans that follow Sunderland, there's capable people mm-hmm. who could do a job in an independent manner. And with the required skills, either the experience of boards or how they run or finances or whatever it might be. But even then, I think if you've just got the right person with the right mindset, but then with fans around them who they can tap in for that expertise, and they act as a conduit on the board, just as Red and White Army do in these structured dialogue meetings, then I can see it working. I think the challenge with it is it would be a bloody hard job for any individual fan to do. You have to sign non-disclosure agreements for certain things. You will have limits to what influence you've got. You'll be a bit of a lightning rod, won't you, for everything, really. So I think fans would need to be aware of that and be supportive of whoever, if there is such a role in the future, whoever did that.
Definitely. I mean, it'll come with a lot of pressure. And I know that there's been some scepticism expressed as part of the fan collective from some of the people in that meeting about whether maybe the current level of engagement and consultation is actually enough as well. And I know that's, you know, it's fantastic to see, but there have been some other examples, haven't there? Like the spirit of Shankly with Liverpool. Yeah. What's happening there?
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, I understand the view that if engagement's good, why do you need it? That's not an illogical conclusion mm-hmm. to make. However, it's when it's not good.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's peaks and troughs with any club, and no more so than Sunderland. And if you look at what happened with the Big Six, and they all have structured dialogue, but they didn't have fans on the board, and nobody knew that they were going to make this move. And that's what it's to protect against, stuff like that. Stuff, you know, when they're messing about with your heritage, with your sporting integrity, with the history of your club, or jeopardising the future of your club. That's why you need a fan on the board, and that's massively important. But Spirit of Shankly, they pushed the club. And Spirit of Shankly's been a supporters trust for a long time, and they're very successful and one of the biggest. And they have it sort of enshrined now and set in stone that there needs to be that supporter engagement, and that there is a supporter on the board. This is regardless of who owns the club. This is written into, you know, how the club will act. Time will tell how successful that will be. Obviously, it's not tried and tested, and I'm guessing with all these things, you know, whoever's creating these rules, there'll always be a bit of wiggle room. So we'll have to watch and see how that goes. But it's a good step forward, and there's other clubs looking to do that. Chelsea and Spurs as well spring to mind. So it's exciting, and the way the wind's blown is really, like you say, put a bit of a rocket booster under fan power and fan activism. And the fan-led review it's just the timing is phenomenal, really. And you talk about own goals in football, you could never score a bigger own goal than what the so-called Big Six have done, because it's just had a huge effect in giving it a lot more impetus, the fan-led review, that is, which is actually ongoing as we speak.
Yeah.
So the FSA is heavily involved in all of that.
So, I mean, I was just gonna mention that I saw the other day that some of the consultations with fan groups in different parts of the country have started. It's not physically touring, is it? It's all going to be on Zoom, isn't it? The evidence taken.
Yes, that's right, Rich. There was an intention to get around the country at one point, but with not being exactly sure of what, you know, what restrictions will be lifted and when, and also it's just more efficient. You're talking about volunteers meeting up with the MPs and the panel, it was just a lot easier to do it. So it's sort of been carved up by levels of the game. So right from the top of the Premier League through to the national game, the women's game. And then there'll be other offshoot sort of networks that they'll be talking to, which is networks that actually already make up the structure of the FSA. So community-owned clubs, there'll be some specific evidence from them, from the Fans for Diversity group, that sort of thing. So they'll get a really sort of rounded picture and feedback from fans who were involved locally and sort of quite clued up, because they'll be involved probably with the local supporters group or the local fanzine or whatever. So the fans who have probably met with a club and that sort of thing, and understand the tensions of structured dialogue and all of that. So it should work really, really well, I think.
So if an individual listener, an individual Sunderland fan, wants to get involved in the process, is the best way for them to do that through Red and White Army, through the kind of the Sports Trust and the existing fan groups?
Yeah, through Red and White Army or if they're members of any other groups, it's about making your voice heard through that. And there'll become a point where we had a bit of a push where fans were lobbying MPs everywhere around the country, and there'll probably come a point where we need to do that again as well. So once the findings come through, not to prejudge that, but hopefully there'll be some good stuff in there. Then obviously the next phase is actually initiating that change, which will be a whole new challenge.
Yeah.
And we'll need fans to rally once more when it comes to that.
Yeah, it'll be about getting MPs to make sure that there's parliamentary time given to passing through any legislation that's needed and things like that. So there's definitely lots more to do around that. So we've got the new season coming up. Hopefully fans going to be back. I've just been watching the cricket. There was 18,000 inside Edgbaston. It sounded amazing. The Euros with fans as well. What are the Trust's plans for the new season? There was talk at the meeting of finding new ways to engage teenage fans who might have kind of dropped away a little bit over the last 18 months or so.
Yes, that's right. One of the subgroups that's set up was looking at like the match day experience and looking at families and how families engage and how younger fans engage with the club. So there'll be a representative from Red and White Army along with the other groups who will form a subgroup around that and try to work with the club to understand what that demographic of fan wants and what's going to maximise the chances of them returning to football, because a lot of people have obviously discovered other things or just fell out of the habit, realised they can live without it. And you've sort of missed a generation, really, with how long this has went on for. That sort of rite of passage, you move from through your teenage years to start to go yourself and end up, you know, like in Roker Park would have been, you end up at the back of the football end sort of thing. There's a lot of fans have missed that, and that's part of when it grabbed you as well, like, you know, for the longer haul. So it's trying to look at all of that and look at what things the club can do. Again, on the pitch is what really matters here, but what can you do as fans when you can't influence the squad we recruit and how we play? Well, we can, thankfully, because of engagement, influence everything else about the match day. So from fan zones to what's offered, you know, on the concourse and what the concourses look like and making them feel more like our home rather than just slate grey cold places. So getting loads of artwork and or the flags and all that sort of stuff, and just make it as good as it can be, really.
Yeah, it's going to be really important, isn't it? And what one big theme, I think, from what the club was saying in those minutes is that they're really keen to get fans to the ground earlier, to keep us there longer after, spending more money, basically, on their products, in their outlets. For me, if that feels like it's going to be a really hard job for them, I know it was the focus of their kind of customer survey as well. People are set. I mean, I am set in my ways around going to the match when I'm up in the northeast, especially in the winter. People are very keen to kind of get there with the, you know, minimum amount of time before the game starts, and then get home as quick or get the pub as quick as they can. Do you see that that's going to be a really hard sell for many Sunderland fans?
I think you're right. Definitely it will be. But thankfully, that was touched on in the meeting, actually. And they were quick to say, look, we cannot fully compete with like the pub experience, and we're not going to replace that. But if they can just be that little bit more attractive and just... and it not just be, you know, serve a few beers because we have to, that sort of attitude. If they can put a bit of thought into it, then, you know, even just some small gains. First of all, they're just offering something better and being respectful to the customer base, the fans. And if they can, you know, because of the numbers that go there, it wouldn't take too much to drive quite a decent bit of extra income. But you cannot replicate the pub, the pre-match or post-match pub on a concourse, especially in the winter. You could probably achieve it a bit more with a well-thought-out fan zone, which would obviously require some indoor space as well. Mm-hmm. I think there is ways you could get that right. It might take quite a bit of expenditure to do it, and a bit of land and property and all of that, but I could see there'd be potential there if they're really serious about that.
No, I think it could work, and we've seen out other grounds as well, and obviously every ground's different. They've got a lot more land to play with around the stadium alike than some places. So it'd be really interesting to see what they come up with. And you know, especially for people with kids like we do, getting to the ground early and doing stuff in the fan zone is actually becoming part of my routine. And if there was more there, and if it was a little bit better organised than it has been in the past, maybe we would stick around a bit more. So... we've gone through Sunderland, we've gone through the minutes. Obviously, you've got a hat with your day job with the FSA, and we talked about the review, but there's obviously other big issues going on in football at the minute with the Euros, with fans. If Sunderland fans are planning on going along to any of the games in the Euros, how would the FSA advise Sunderland fans who are going to go to support the players who are choosing to take a knee before kickoff in particular, because that's a big hot issue?
Yeah, there's been obviously a lot of discussion about this, and lots of column inches taken up around it. And I think from the FSA's point of view, we're calling on fans to support the players, as England fans do brilliantly well, but support them throughout and from start to finish here, and support what they're doing. The players feel like it's the right thing to do, and it just seems such a bizarre thing to walk into the ground and the first thing you do is boo your own players, regardless. And the FSA are encouraging fans to not boo and for those that are in tune with what the players are doing to applaud. I mean, obviously, you know, you hear the boos more so than you hear the sort of silent respect that you would in the ground. So it's an unfortunate thing to have to talk about. But yeah, it's about support the players and support their choice.
Yeah. Yeah, and totally. I mean, we as a fanzine stand solidly behind anti-racism campaigns, and I know that the football supporters movement in general, especially in Britain, I mean, it's one of the remarkable things that just how fan-led a lot of the anti-racism has been throughout the history of English football. It's been the response of fans that's moved the dial on along with players. And it's the players and the fans really in football who make the game, don't we?
We've been running a Fans for Diversity campaign for years now and had set up various different supporter groups in the LGBT community and across various ethnicity and race. And we've achieved some great things through that.
Mm-hmm.
The guy, Anwar Uddin, my colleague who's been running that, has done some amazing stuff and have actually led the way on a lot of things. And it's always been about, you know, celebrating all of that good stuff where fans do to gather around those issues, but in a really positive way. And it's about shining a light on all of that, because whilst you hear the ugly stuff that makes the news, there's far, far more good stuff going on.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we try to focus on that without belittling or ignoring the serious issues as they arise.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's going to be a fun-filled summer of football, and then we've got transfers coming after that. I'm going to wish you all the best, and thank you very much for your time this evening, Dave.
Thanks very much, Rich. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and listeners, you can give us a like and a rating and a share on your podcaster of choice, and keep listening. We've got some interesting stuff coming up over the summer, which I'm sure you'll hear more about really soon. But thanks a lot. See ya.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.